Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 193 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. We have three cases today. The first is from the Illinois Appellate Court, 5th District, Tolbert v. Odom Concrete Products, Inc. The second is from the Illinois Appellate 2nd District, King v. El Paraiso del Pacifico, Inc. And the third is from the Indiana Supreme Court, Angela Y. Smith, Dylan Williams, and $11,180 in the United States currency. First State of Indiana. Turning to our first case. Thank you, Justice Cates. If you listen to the argument in Tolbert v. Odom Concrete Products, Inc., it's hard to understand what was going on for a long period of time. Then the justice asked, so far I haven't heard you argue. Maybe I'm confused. Aren't you here asking us to reverse summary judgment? Appellant's counsel replied, absolutely. Justice Cates, well, I hear you talking about how ReadyMix controlled their employee, and how Millstone Weber controlled their employee, but aren't you asking us to look at how Millstone Weber controlled the ReadyMix employee? Appellant's counsel, that's the issue. Justice Cates, I haven't heard that argument, and maybe I'm missing it, but I hear you saying ReadyMix picked the driver to do this and do that, could have discharged him, but how is it that Millstone Weber controlled the ReadyMix employee such that we should reverse? Where's the question of fact? Appellant's counsel, I think you made my point for me, Your Honor. Millstone Weber did not control ReadyMix driver, and because they didn't control the ReadyMix driver, they did not assume a position of employment over the ReadyMix driver. Justice Cates, then you have summary judgment. Appellant's counsel, their argument is that Millstone Weber was a de facto employer of Rogers, who was the ReadyMix driver, and if Millstone Weber was the employer of Rogers, then my client's only remedy for Stephen Tolbert is through workers' compensation. Justice Cates, OIC. Appellant's counsel, because it would be a co-employee, and to your point, Millstone Weber did not exert control over the ReadyMix driver. The only coordinator that gave information, the control at all times remained with ReadyMix over Rogers, and because they retrained and retained that control. Hey, why don't I turn over, you can continue on this, and the kind of the 15 minutes it took to actually get to the point here.
Right. And I listened to this. I stuck with it for a while because I'm like trying to figure out what was going on. And what you have, and I'm still not, I really wish we have a clear delineation. So Rogers, make sure I got this right, was an employee of ReadyMix.
Yes.
And the plaintiff here, Tolbert, was an employee of Millstone Weber. And Tolbert is injured by Rogers. And the argument is that because Millstone Weber controlled, the argument was that Millstone Weber essentially controlled Rogers because they were the general contractor. It made him a co-employee. It made Tolbert a co-employee of Rogers. And if Tolbert is a co-employee of Rogers because Rogers was essentially seconded to Millstone Weber by its control of him as opposed to his employer ReadyMix, then the only remedy that Tolbert can get is from workers' comp. He can't, because if you're injured by a co-employee, then it's covered by comp. Now, the exception would be if the one employee punches another employee, that's not covered by comp. But there's no allegation of intentional conduct here. The allegation here is that Rogers was an incompetent. And so they're building a road, and Rogers is told to undertake this road building, and he makes a pass and he does a really crappy job. And they give him a second chance and it doesn't get any better. And Tolbert is injured on the second pass. And so this idea is that and that's the crux of the issue, is what do you need in order to show a control issue. And if you have control, if it's a loaned employee, that is, a loaned employee or a borrowed employee, what is necessary to show for that person to be under your control? It's not simply who wrote you the check. It's who could direct your when to show up, what to do, how to do it. Here's the equipment to use. Here's who your supervisor is, and most importantly, who could discharge you. There's like seven factors they go through. It starts sounding like it. And summary judgment was granted here on the basis that this Rogers fellow was effectively a Millstone Weber employee. And by dint of that fact, there was the exclusive remedy for Tolbert was in workers' comp. Now, workers' comp is obviously, you can't sue your employer in workers' comp. You're limited to the kinds of remedies, these kinds of things. So this is, we've talked about this trade-off between comp and, what the employee gets. Well, what does the employee get for these reduced recovery that he can get? Well, he doesn't have to prove causation. And so that's much to the chagrin of the employers, but that's the grand bargain. And it goes back in Illinois to 1911 when we enacted the Workers' Compensation Act. Illinois, I believe, was the first state to have it, to come up with this scheme. And it's well over 100 years old, and it works pretty well. The object of workers' comp is to get the injured worker immediate medical care, which has to be paid. The company has to have it. There's criminal penalties if you don't. And the idea is to get the employee care and get him back to work. It pays him temporary total disability in the form of about 2/3 of his income. It pays him his medical bills. It allows, and then in exchange for that, he gives up obviously a lot of civil rights. And by civil rights, I mean right to sue his employer civilly. That's what I mean when I say civil rights. Not in the usual way we use civil rights. But although it is a civil right to be able to bring a civil action, that is in the Seventh Amendment. So it is a civil right, but that's not, strictly speaking, what we're talking about. And he, so he's able to sue, but you're always able to sue others, third parties, who are alleged to have injured you. And one of the defenses that is sometimes brought, as it was here, and it's somewhat more common in the construction context than it is in other contexts, though not exclusive to the construction context, it can apply in any context, is this loaned, borrowed employee situation. And I'll never forget when I was a young lawyer, I went over to argue one of these motions, and Judge, we had a pretty good loaned employee argument. And it was in front of Judge Ward. If you remember Judge Ward, it was many years ago. He turns to opposing counsel and he says, counsel, it's not much, basically makes my argument for me and says to me, counsel, you got anything to add? Judge, I got nothing. You're doing just fine. I'm going to let you go. And he ended up ruling in our favor and then gave us 304A language, even though we hadn't asked for it. Because he's like, yeah, what's the point of this? Because it was a borrowed agent issue. So the question here, in this case, the court granted summary judgment, and there seems to be some facts that may support that, whether he was actually loaned or not, and whether they were co-employees. We'll see what happens here. The thing that it just took a while to get there. He was talking all around it as if you understood what was going on. And it was plain. Justice Cates did not understand what was going on, what he was arguing. And then she probes a little bit and gets some answers. It's like, if you just started with that, sometimes it's a balancing act in oral argument between giving the facts and giving the and getting into the legal argument. And many times plaintiff's counsel will talk a lot about the facts, how sympathetic their guy is, all the injuries, yada, yada, and then not so much focus on the law. And then you don't really know what the legal question is. In this case, he jumped to the law because you didn't know what the factual predicate was. And so oftentimes when you listen to an oral argument to really figure out what had to go on, what's going on, is you have to wait till the appellee's argument to understand. So what are we arguing about here? What's really the dispute? And I'll go back to something I heard Justice Hyman say. I think he was judge at that time. He may have been justice, but he certainly was at least judge. He said when he starts reading briefs to get ready for an argument or to decide a case, he starts with the response brief. Then he reads the reply brief. And then he might read the opening brief. Because by reading the response brief and the reply brief, he gets crystallized as to what the real issues are. And if he needs facts, I mean, that's where you'll find them, is in the opening brief, because you have the long statement of facts and all the reference to the record or whatever. But he says his practice, and I think he did this when he was on, when he was in the circuit court, he started with the response brief and then went to the reply brief, because it's also less reading and you get really to the right to the heart of the matter. If you've got, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of cases, as a circuit court judge, you don't have that many as an appellate court justice, but they're just bigger, just more reading. If you cut right to the chase. So knowing that if you have a case in front of them, it's very hard. And we're going to talk about the rule of the week. Sometimes it's very hard to know who your panel is. You don't know who your panel is when you file your briefs, is to, you know, think about how you structure what you write, knowing how the justices are likely to read them. But also important to be helpful to the court. I think once counsel got to the argument, you understood what he was getting at. I don't know the record, so I don't know if he's right or not on that point. But at least he was able to explain why he believed what the legal issue was and how the facts played into it. And you've got such a fact-intensive analysis. It's kind of hard to see. Summary judgment is a tall order. Obviously, the defendant's got it here. We'll see if it stands. Dan, what are your thoughts?
No, Pat, I agree. And I think this is a good lesson in, and again, knowing your audience. And we've talked about Easterbrook occasionally. He says that they're generalists. I mean, you have to understand that the audience you're speaking to might not necessarily know the full facts. And like you said, it's a fine line, though, because you only have limited time. So, you know, sometimes panels will say, you know, we know the facts, get to the issue here, but they don't
usually say that. If you say Rogers was the employee of Ready Mix,
right,
my guy was the employee of Millstone, the court erred in finding that Rogers was the employee of Millstone and therefore the exclusive remedy. If that's where he had started, three sentences,
right. I know,
and then gone up, we wouldn't be talking. We'd be talking about this case, just not in this way.
Yeah, and again, this. In the arbitrations that I hear oftentimes, you know, the parties produce thick piles of paper and a lot of witnesses and names are mentioned, and it's like a novel where you set it all up in the preface and then you don't use half of it. You know, it's like, then again, I think this is a good lesson and again, giving your audience enough information so that they can understand, like you said, even if it's three sentences, something, so that you can kind of set the framework for what the hell you're talking about. Right. Otherwise, you're just kind of, if you're just talking about the law, and I think Michael Hyman has a pretty good, I think it's pretty good approach, because the response brief is going to attack or address all the issues in the opening brief. Like you said, it doesn't, hopefully, and it gets rid of the facts.
And if they don't, you'll hear about it in the reply brief.
Right. And so those two briefs, you know, not a bad way to approach it and get guidance.
Yeah, I young lawyers who I work with will get tired of me saying, they'll give me a brief or a motion. It'll start with a history lesson. This case is about XYZ. This is a motion, not a history lesson. The motion should start. You can, that to be the second paragraph. That's fine. The first paragraph is, we win because. Tell the court what the issue is. They got hundreds, thousands of cases. You got to tell them what you need, what you get it and why you're entitled to it. If you can't say it in a sentence, you need to reconsider filing that motion, because you've got to be able to say it quickly and succinctly. As Einstein said, if you can't explain something to an elementary school student, you need to go back and understand it better, because you don't understand it well enough. You've got to go back and because you don't understand it. So go back and understand it better.
Yep.
That's a key. And as you say, know your audience. That's always a good, and the limitations of your audience when they're very busy judges.
Right.
So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with our second case, which is another Marshall versus Burger King type case. We've referenced it before. We're not fans, and here we have another one, but different. Yeah.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment two of episode 193, and did the circuit court properly grant summary judgment to the defendant restaurant on the basis that the parking lot merely furnished a condition but was not the cause and fact of the plaintiff's injury when a vehicle jumped the parking bumper and careened into the building, causing plaintiff's injury? Distinguishing Marshall versus Burger King, for those that aren't familiar, that's the 2006 Illinois Supreme Court case where a car in Rockford went off the road and careened into a Burger King and caused injury, and they sued Burger King for not having appropriate bollard or something to protect flying cars. This is not Back to the Future, but except in Marshall versus Burger King, which held on a motion to dismiss that a duty existed because it was foreseeable that such incidents would occur. The circuit court found, and the defendant appellee argued before the Illinois Appellate Court Second District, that the Marshall court merely dealt with the duty element, but did not address the breach or causation elements. The plaintiff appellant argued that in spite of no prior incidents, compliance with local ordinance by the defendant, and no expert testimony opposing summary judgment, the plaintiff's injury was foreseeable and that whether the construction of the parking lot was the but-for cause was an issue for the jury. Dan, tell us about the non-flying but still careening automobile.
Yeah, this car drove in near the front doors and went right in through the doors. It was a drive-through, a new meaning of drive-through. And
yeah,
Pat,
exactly.
You posted some pictures of it, Pat, some interesting pictures from Google of this storefront. The feet of the glass was the doorfront. The justices came out pretty much swinging, asking a bunch of questions about whether the defendant. One question was early on in the oral arguments was whether or not this tenant, because they're leasing this property, they don't own it, whether they had the ability to change the parking lot. What was offered up by the appellant counsel was that this restaurant does in fact have full control to be able to change. There was talk about instead of making them perpendicular to the front of the store, they'd make them parallel.
Yeah, and, because people in the suburbs love that.
Yeah. And again, I don't get the full sense of how you get off the road and you could do parallel parking. Might be very difficult. One of the justices asked was, like you said, trying to get to how this was the same case as Marshall versus Burger King, and he said, was it the foreseeability element based on Marshall? And he said, this is Mexican food instead of American burgers, but that was kind of his the only distinction. He was trying to compare that case, like you said, no flying cars here, but response from the appellant counsel was that foreseeability there was in Marshall, there was a duty under Marshall but like I said, there's multiple elements here and the appellant counsel tried to inform the justice that, you know, this is a distinguishable case here. This is not the same case as Marshall in terms of
duties.
Well,
that was the appellee's counsel.
Yeah. Appellee's counsel. Yeah. Like you said, Pat, one of the questions was whether or not this was in conformance with Waukegan code, and then the appellant counsel said it's not dispositive negligence. That negligence is a jury question, and so you can't. And we've talked about this before. One of the things that sometimes comes into play, we've talked about it on elevator cases and other cases, is that oftentimes what the defendants will argue in these cases is that they were in full compliance with whatever municipal code is in effect for the issue that's been being addressed. And the general approach on these cases is that, again, compliance with ordinances does not necessarily mean that you get off scot-free, because the ordinances are not necessarily intended to establish liability or to establish duties. They're more to establish safety in some cases, such as this, or to establish the traffic flow or whatever. So again, the appellant's argument is that this was on a motion for summary judgment, that negligence is a jury question, that the breach of the duties jury question, and it's not enough that there's compliance with the ordinance. The appellant was trying to argue heavily, and I'm not sure how well it went over, that the ordinance, again, is not designed to stop vehicles from going in establishments, that there were various things that could have been put in here, bumps or other types of parking things that could have prevented this type of situation from happening. The challenge in my mind of Marshall versus Burger King pad and other cases like this is that to me, it creates almost a super duty on establishments. We've talked about cases in Home Depot and other things to somehow take every step of anything that's foreseeable. And we've talked about this before. I think we as lawyers, we like to be very risk adverse, and we do, you know, for public companies, the risk factors can go on for pages and pages, like a roll of toilet paper. You know, that the bricks could fall out of the sky, that there could be, you know, avian flu that destroys the world, all these things. And the cases like this, you know, if this gets reversed, it seems to open up for establishments kind of a much bigger a burden on them. There was some discussion, Pat, in the oral arguments about whose burden it was on summary judgment to prove foreseeability, and here the moving party is the defendant, so the appellant was arguing that it's the defendant who has to establish overcome the burden on showing foreseeability here in this case. And one of the justices asked, you know, this is not a case where there's an accelerator or a child or a dog or anything else in this case that was the cause of this car driving through. What happened here was this individual simply, put the foot on the gas to continue to park for whatever reason, didn't stop. So, and I think the justice was trying to just get to, again, you know, is there some kind of, when you look at proximate cause and you look at someone that has a child in the car or a dog or some other distraction that could have precipitated. Here we just have someone who, again, put their foot back in the accelerator, and pretty interesting. The appellee, you know, their argument was the proximate cause is a two-prong. It's cause and effect, and then legal cause. And they cited to Lee versus CTA and some other cases about, is there something in this parking lot that, again, made it foreseeable that there would be an accident versus some other type of parking lot. So, interesting case. And
I want to emphasize what you just talked about, is the element of causation has two aspects. It has legal cause and cause in fact. Foreseeability only goes to legal cause. And and as we, I think I recently posted about, the definition of legal cause is different from the foreseeability for the purposes of the duty element. So the duty element has within it foreseeability as to whether something, a duty should be imposed in the first instance. And then you get to causation and you get those two parts. You've got foreseeability, that's legal cause, and you have but-for cause. And the plaintiff spent a lot of time talking about legal cause and linking it to the foreseeability found in duty. And that's where Justice McLaren was focused.
Yep.
That's only half of that argument, because it doesn't address the cause. In fact, was this a mere condition or was it a cause? And then it, none of that deals with the breach issue, which doesn't have a foreseeability element to it at all. Is, was there a breach of the duty by not having the bollards or what have you? I think there probably was a breach, because if it's foreseeable and you don't have the bollards and the thing occurs, well, right, that seems like a breach. So I don't think that's going to work. So now you're on to, okay, was it the cause in fact? In other words, this dovetails with a superseding cause. Simply because something is foreseeable and it happens doesn't make you strictly liable. There still has to be a causal relationship between that. And merely because it was foreseeable, that only gets you halfway through the causation element. You still have to show but for cause, cause in fact, and that the failure to have the bollard caused the injury. Right. Well, that's a stretch.
That's a tough hurdle.
That's the issue. Ultimately, did the absence of the bollard cause the injury? No, didn't. The person putting their foot on the accelerator when it needed to go on the brake caused the injury. The bollard would have been an inanimate object. It didn't cause the absence of it or the presence of it didn't cause or not cause anything. The thing that caused the injury was the driver who made a mistake. Fortunately, this person was hurt. So that's the real key, is breaking down the aspects of the element and understanding that foreseeability only deals with one of them. So with that, we'll take our next break and come back with, I always love the dollar amounts in civil forfeiture case, but we have people. There's people. Right. Angela Smith, Dylan Williams, and $11,180 in United States currency versus the state of Indiana, and one of the most incredible stories about money ever. We'll be back.
Hey, Podium and Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment 3 of episode 193 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. And the Indiana Supreme Court has heard another civil forfeiture case. And Angela Y. Smith, Dylan Williams, and $11,180 in United States currency versus state of Indiana. The court will consider the following. Quote, the state seized $11,180 in a parole-related search of Dylan Williams' apartment. His aunt, Angela Smith, intervened, asserting the currency was hers, and she had given it to her nephew to hold. The Marion Superior Court issued an order finding the currency was subject to forfeiture, but the order did not state Smith did not own the currency. The Court of Appeals affirmed, rejecting Smith's argument that the state did not provide a connection between the currency and criminal activity, because that argument presupposed Smith had standing to make the argument as the owner of the currency. Smith et al. Versus State, 213 Northeast 3rd, 1120, Indiana Court of Appeals, July 24th, 2023, memorandum, vacated. The Indiana Supreme Court has granted Smith's petition to transfer and assume jurisdiction over the case. End quote. Pat, tell us about this case.
So, Dylan Williams, apparently no stranger to the law, has a search conducted by the police, and they come in and they find stacks of cash that they claim is consistent with how drug dealers store their money. I don't even know what that means. There's someone in the house that has an electronic scale in their pocket that the police officer says is consistent with the kind of scale that drug dealers use. So why do you bring a scale to someone's house? I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's susceptible to the conclusion that someone's weighing out drugs of some kind.
Maybe making and, drinks, you know.
Who knows? I don't know. I mean,
he's on a diet. He's on a, you know, a caveman diet. Who knows?
Yeah. I don't know, but there he is. And then there's this $11,000 and some dollars in cash. And Aunt Angela intervenes into the case. And Aunt Angela says, well, I gave Dylan, nephew Dylan, $15,000, right, to hold for me. And I'm kind of pissed that he only has $11,180 of it left. But here's the receipt, the withdrawal receipt for the $15,000. And she lives in Minnesota, apparently, and got into a beef with her, or was a victim of domestic violence and was trying to keep the money away from her abuser. So she gave it to Dylan Williams, her nephew, to hold. And he promptly spent some of it, is her version. But that he gave her this money as a bailment. And she wants the money. So there's numerous issues here. One of the issues is, does Angela Smith have standing to intervene and to seek recovery of this money, saying it's my money, it's not his money involved in the drugs? Now remember, and the reason why we say they were considering this again is because if you recall the Tyson Timbs case, which is a case that went to the Supreme Court of the United States, was a civil asset forfeiture case from Indiana. They've had a couple since. I think we've talked about some of them. This is another one of civil forfeiture. So it's been quite an issue that's arisen in Indiana of some note. So the question is, you know, first is, does she have standing? She says it's her money. If it is her money, she has standing to say it wasn't involved in a crime. What she doesn't know is, can she match the serial numbers on the dollar bill, on the bills? These weren't dollar bills. These are apparently larger denomination bills to the ones that were there. You know, money is fungible. Is it's the same $11,180 that, or what's left of the $15,000 that she gave her nephew to look at, to hold for her, and not hold very well, apparently. I don't know what the standard is, but there's nothing to contradict her testimony,
right?
Which is her lawyer's point. Speaking of her lawyer, how in the devil do you finance a case to the Supreme Court of any state, having gone through the appellate court and the trial court, where there's $11,000 at stake? I mean, really, how do you finance that? How much money did she pay this guy? Or is he taking, I mean, he can't be taking it on a contingency. Is he hoping for a recovery of fees under Section 1983? Certainly not in the state action. I don't understand how he's being paid. Maybe it's a pro bono. Maybe it's a through a public advocacy associate. I don't know. But it's just a matter of curiosity as to how you finance such litigation when so literally just not enough money at stake to fight like this. But yeah, Here we are. Interesting case nonetheless. So you've got issues of standing. You've got issues of what proof she has to show. Who has the burden? Does the government have to disprove that it was hers by somehow? I don't know how they would do that. I don't understand what they would do other than to say that she didn't meet her burden of showing it was hers. Remember, the burden is very low for showing that it was involved in a criminal activity. But merely that because the money was was wrapped in a manner consistent and there was someone with a scale. Did they find drugs, Dan?
I don't think they did.
I don't know if they found drugs or not.
I'm not quite sure.
And if they did, was it with the money? And I mean, how could you relate this money to those drugs? I mean, plainly the police believe he's a drug dealer. If he is or not, I don't know. I probably a pretty good guess, but shouldn't get you very far when you're talking about taking someone's property.
Right.
Just because the cops think something, okay, that's what we have trials for. Now, the thing in civil asset forfeiture is it's by preponderance of the evidence. It's not beyond a reasonable doubt. And so you have this crude mix of how the law comes together. And it's a real mess because you're alleging criminal activity, but you don't have to prove it. And you only have to relate it on a, you don't have to prove it on a preponderance of the evidence standard. And I'm not a fan of civil asset forfeiture. This is an example why. On the flip side of what the plaintiff or what Ms. Smith has spent or her lawyer has spent in trying to get this $11,000, you have all the money the government has spent for $11,000. Really? This is what we're doing? I don't understand that use of resources, both from the office, you know, the police officers, the state's attorneys, and now the attorney general, and now the judiciary, both at the trial level and then the appellate courts, and then now the Supreme Court. What an unbelievable amount of resources over $11,000.
Right.
I have a hard time from a policy perspective. That shouldn't inform the outcome at all. But from a policy perspective, I have to think we have better ways to spend our money than the state trying to get $11,000. The lady says it was hers. Maybe it was. Maybe it wasn't. I don't know. But do you really have to expend these kinds of resources to go after $11,000? Are the police department in this jurisdiction that hard up for dough that they need to do this? I don't know. Do the young lawyers of the AG's office and the state's attorney's office really need that much training to go fight about $11,000? I don't know. I have my doubts. The war on drugs leads to strange outcomes, and this is one of them, a strange use of resources. So with that, anything else to add on that, Dan, before we move on?
No.
All right, so we'll move on to BI, BIPA, GIPA, IPA. What news, Dan? First, tell us about the settlement in the BNSF case that was pending before Judge Kennelly in the Northern District of Illinois, the $228 million verdict.
Yeah, and this was an open question for a long time, Pat. There was news, I think, late last year that this case had settled or was in the process of settling. Nobody knew for how much or anything else. And this was after Cathron was decided, where it's the Supreme Court, as we talked about on the show, said, you know, it says may award up to. And so it's not mandatory that it's 1,000 or 5,000 per hit. And this case was kind of seen as a bellwether of what that number might look like. It's still pretty large. It was $75 million settlement that was agreed to, and it was disclosed last week by Judge Kennelly. And it sounds like it'll be approved. And so $75 million on 228, about one-third of the jury verdict. This was a case where in the post-trial briefs, I think we were informed and I think verified that the plaintiffs had argued that it was a $1 billion case, not a $228 million case, and that the jury under-calculated. But in any event, this is the first case that went to a jury trial on BIPA that we're aware of. And this was a case where truck drivers were using their thumbprints to get into the depot, or I'm not sure exactly what the facility they were getting into, but they were using their thumbprints. And the allegations were they had failed to disclose the policy as was required by BIPA, and then it failed to get informed consent. So an interesting case, and we may see additional cases come out. But to my knowledge, most of these cases are not getting to the jury trial, right, Pat? I mean, it's
right.
I mean, this one got to it. The reason for it is, as we've talked about, these cases are so giant that in some cases where I think where employers especially that have used this the biometric information, they try to figure out a way to resolve these cases on a very discounted rate per incident. So it's
There's plenty of them, and you gotta have, but you have to have some to kind of set the standard, and you know some defendants are willing to oblige and try the case, and they did, and it didn't go well the first time, but you know, in light of Cathron, I think, and signals from Judge Kennelly, they came to a more reasonable number, you know, about a third of what that had been awarded less than a third of what had been awarded previously. But still, any money is too much in this case because nobody has actually been damaged. Anyway, that brings us to the flip side of the cover or to, of the liability to the coverage. And Citizens Insurance Company of America versus Mullins is a BIPA coverage case decided by Judge Alonzo of the District Court, the Northern District of Illinois. On Thursday, I think it is, he reversed himself following a motion to reconsider in light of the Visual Pack case. So sit with me here. When Dalco came down last year from the Seventh Circuit and said there's coverage, late last year, the First District says, the Illinois Appellate Court First District, in an opinion written by Justice Ellis, says, Judge Rovner, Seventh Circuit, you're all wet, you're wrong, there's no coverage. Then Thermaflex gets argued before the Seventh Circuit. Well, we talked about it on the show. It's still pending, which is important. And that's after the, you know, Judge Ellis issued, or the First District issued its opinion written by Judge Ellis, Justice Ellis. But still not the Supreme Court, still not the Supreme Court of Illinois. And so what eerie guess does the court make? Does it just wait till the Supreme Court takes and decides a Visual Pack, or what does it do? You would think that would hold things for the district courts while that's going on. Not so. So in the motion to reconsider, they point out, the insurers do, that the language is like Visual Pack and not like Wendalka. In fact, it's the title that's like Visual Pack and not like Wendalka. And on that basis, Judge Alonzo reverses himself, holds that there is not coverage, and that he's not bound by Wendalka because of that distinguishing feature. He then rules on the other exclusions consistent with Visual Pack that had not been ruled on in the Wendalko case. So very interesting goings on that a judge would really put his neck out there and distinguish what the Seventh Circuit had done, even while there's a case pending that might give the Seventh Circuit the opportunity, or does give the Seventh Circuit the opportunity to reverse itself, but still before the ultimate arbiters of this issue, the Illinois Supreme Court, have decided. Dan, thoughts to add about that?
No, very interesting development, and I wrote about this for the Daily Law Bulletin for my column tomorrow, and I suggested that hopefully the Illinois Supreme Court decides to take a case somewhere along this chain.
They'll take the Visual Pack case. I think they have to, frankly.
I think so too.
They have to take it,
and we'll get some kind of definitive answer. And given the Supreme Court in recent years on BIPA and other things, who knows what that looks like? But
we have no idea.
But we'll get something on this for sure.
They've got a very strong opinion from Justice Ellis from which to work.
They do.
I will say that it is a. In fact, I cited it to a client, not in BIPA context, but on the illusory issue yesterday. I sent an email with, hey, see this case about what him talking about what is illusory coverage and what isn't. Just because an exclusion takes away most coverage doesn't mean it takes away all coverage and doesn't render the exclusion unenforceable. An important principle.
And as we've talked about, that's long been the standard of kind of policy drafting on these things. If there's still some coverage, if it swallows up all coverage, then you might have an issue. But this, if it's just because it's a broad exclusion, doesn't mean it's that coverage is illusory. So
that's right, which is the opposite of what the court held in Wendalka.
Yeah.
Which brings us to a COVID-19 BI case. Who knew those were still out there? They are. This is from the Court of Appeals of Indiana, Purdue University versus American Home Assurance, affirming summary judgment in favor of the insurer. We figured we're obligated to talk about those as long as we have this segment that came out, and so there we are. Which brings us to our prediction, sure to go wrong this week. We were 2-0, Dan. Dan is 295.5, 61.5, and 21. I am 292.5, 64.5, and 21. Speaking of columns in the Law Bulletin, McDonald versus Wagon Maker that we discussed, both these cases that we came out discussed on episode 190. I wrote about McDonald versus Wagon Maker on my for my column for this week. I submitted it this morning. And this is whether the crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege should extend to defamatory conduct. The court said no. It talks about the procedure that should be employed. It says the circuit court didn't employ that procedure, that it misapplied Illinois law. Basically, the circuit court got it wrong every way the circuit court could get it wrong, and reverses the circuit court. A very good day for lawyers and their clients. This is not a defense or plaintiff valence. This is not a civil or criminal valence. This is just lawyer valence and client valence. And this is good for everybody.
Right.
Except maybe Mr. McDonald, the plaintiff in the case. But this is very helpful. Dan, thoughts on the McDonald versus Wagon Maker case?
No, I think you're right. And if it had come out the other way, that would have been very problematic from a lawyer interaction perspective. So
it would. Speaking of things swallowing the rule, that's what could happen in this circumstance. If you're going to start allowing any intentional tort to be an exception to the rule of attorney-client privilege, you seriously erode the attorney-client privilege and client's ability to get counsel. Not good. Which brings us to Tokio Marine versus Altum. This was the insurance coverage case before the Seventh Circuit. The court held that or affirmed the district court that there was a duty to defend this explosion at a facility in East Chicago. Still trying to figure out why this is pending in the Northern District of Illinois, but there it is. Or why it was filed in the Northern District of Illinois and then went to the Seventh Circuit. I'm not sure I understand all that, but anyway, that's where it is. And the insurer lost. Again, we talked about that on episode 190. Anything to add on that, Dan?
Now, this was the interesting case where it had to do with whether it was caused via transportation, and this was the glob of toxic flammable liquids that was drained and put in the drain, and it
40 gallons of it.
40 gallons. They called it a small. The trucking company said pretty small amount, and it said it didn't matter if it was a full tanker, that it wasn't transportation, but there's a duty to defend here at least.
That's what the court has held. Which brings us to our prediction, sure to go wrong this week, Dan. So we've got Tolbert versus Odom. I think this gets reversed. I think they find a question.
I think it's reversed.
Fact.
Yeah.
I think ultimately counsel saved it.
I think so.
King versus El Paricio del Pacifico. I think, did counsel for the appellee sufficiently explain the distinction with Marshall?
I don't know that they did.
You don't know if he did?
Yeah.
I thought he did.
But yeah.
You don't think so?
Well, I think this case gets affirmed, but yeah.
You think it gets affirmed?
Yeah, okay. I do.
Right.
I think it was close enough.
All right. And then we have Smith versus the current, or Smith and Williams in the currency versus the state of Indiana. I have no idea.
No.
I'm punting on this one.
I think punting's good on that.
And punt.
Yeah.
All right, very good.
We have no predictions on what happens to the money as a plaintiff.
No idea. Which brings us to the rule of the week. Dan, you came up with this one. Tell us about the rule of the week.
Sure. This was there's a movement afoot. There's three circuits at the federal level, including the Seventh Circuit, that does not announce its panels ahead of hearings. And so, as you mentioned early on, Pat, in the first case we talked about, know your audience. In the Seventh Circuit, it's impossible to know your audience. There's seven judges that are active, right? Seven?
No.
More.
I think
there's more.
There's well more. I think there's 11, 12, plus the senior judges.
Yeah. So what happens is when you show up for your hearings on the day that your Seventh Circuit hearing is, you show up in the courtroom, and when the first case comes, the three panelists either are zoomed in, if it's Rovner, or appear on the bench. And so you have no ability.
Well, you find out at 8:30.
8:30, but
at 8:30 you find out, and then the hearing starts at 9.
The challenge,
You have about a half hour.
Yeah, and the challenge, I think the Federal Circuit and one other circuit, I forget which one, there's a movement afoot, though, to make it so that all other circuits, you know the panels well in advance, at least a day in advance. And the benefit of this is if you get, on the Seventh Circuit, for example, if you get Easterbrook on your panel, for sure you shouldn't be using acronyms, but you're also going to get just, Judge Easterbrook's got a unique style about him. And so the argument is that it's helpful to know who your panels are before you, before 8:30, half hour before you're going to argue, because you might tailor your arguments to someone that wrote a particular opinion. Or if you knew that a judge that has a particular viewpoint on certain subject matters, it can help you, and it may not still carry the day, but the thinking is, again, allowing the advocates to be able to prepare more than 30 minutes in advance how they approach a case, depending on the panel they have. So,
having one of my colleagues had an argument in the Seventh Circuit several months ago, and he, came into town and, he had us on speed dial with, here's who my panel is. And, a couple of us responded, here's your, okay, we know who it is. Here's who this person is. Here's this, who appointed, basically who appointed them, what their general bent is, this kind of a thing. And then generally what that three person panel is going to be like. He was prepared for Easterbrook in the event that Judge Easterbrook was on the panel. I can't remember if he was, but I honestly don't remember. But she was prepared for that if that had occurred. But you can't really prepare for the rest of them. And we were able to say, this one was a Trump appointee, this one was a Clinton appointee, this one was, whatever it happened to be. And so you kind of gives you an idea of who you're dealing with and what kinds of questions and what have they ruled on recently and is there anything relevant for your case? And that was about 15 minutes of, just trying to give a best you could, thumbnail sketch to someone that doesn't regularly practice in the Seventh Circuit. Hey, here's what we're doing.
And even if you do practice again, it's almost impossible to moot and be prepared for, every judge that could sit on the case. You just can't do it. And
it's again, a big difference. It's a big difference if you've got, depending on who the judges are.
Difficult. As the cases we cover. So, some are very active. Some you hardly hear from. Some ask, very pointed questions. So yeah, that's, but in any event, I don't know who's behind this movement or if it has any chances of success, but like a lot of things at the federal court level, I wouldn't expect that the Seventh Circuit's going to change anytime soon unless they're forced to by some, I can't imagine the judicial conference or somebody saying you have to do this.
Yeah, who's going to force them?
Why?
Who's got that?
What's the real? It's not like it's a detriment or prejudicial to litigants, the parties. So yeah.
It'd be better for the parties, but that's not enough. That's not enough of a standard. They're not violating anyone's rights and nothing like that.
Right.
You might have a preference, but that doesn't make it a violation of a right. You know who's potentially on the panel. Go get ready. That's what you do. Yeah, you deal with what you got. So with that, we will take our leave, and we will see you next week on the Podium and Panel podcast.
Thank you.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship, Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.